This is Lori Sonkin with WRFI Community Radio News. Shannon Gleason is joining us in the studio tonight. Shannon Gleason is an associate professor in the Department of Labor Relations, Law and History at Cornell. Her research related to the legal limbo of immigrants is relevant to what is happening in our country today. Tonight we're going to talk about how President Trump's immigration policies are impacting Cornell. Welcome to the program, Shannon.
Thank you, Lori.
So about 20% of the students at Cornell are international. How many, do you know how many are undocumented or how many are students that have DACA status, meaning that they came to the U.S. when they were young and under Obama they got, they were allowed to stay and work for 2 years and it's renewable and they can go to school?
Right. I think that's a really great question and one that probably many people have. And I don't have the specific answer to that. I think I would encourage you to maybe speak with someone in the administration about that. But I wanted to first kind of caution us about thinking only about the numbers, right? I think always we want to be sure that we understand who's being impacted by policies. But even when they're a small minority of individuals, we want to be clear about how policies are having inequitable impacts on a population. And especially in an educational institution, we want to think about how we are attracting future educational talent. And so I don't know that number. And I think that it's important for us to think beyond kind of whether or not there's a critical mass.
What is Cornell doing? How is Cornell responding to Trump's policies? I know that Hunter Rawlings has sent out a few emails. What are some of the policy changes?
Sure. So there's a number of different issues on the table that I think the Cornell leadership is attempting to respond to. And Hunter Rawlings did issue a statement laying out some specific sentiments regarding the concerns not only facing students who have the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, are beneficiaries of that or those who are undocumented. But he also was responding to the ban on individuals from seven different countries. And he laid out about five different issues if you go back to that statement. One, he gave a statement about the importance of inclusion, but he, in looking at the community of Cornell as a whole, but he laid out five things. One, promised assistance for those who may be detained. They also committed to honoring the commitments to those individuals with DACA status. They also mentioned resources at the law school for helping those folks who may be detained, as well as representation for those who have deferred action for childhood arrivals. And then there was also a statement regarding the Cornell Police Department, which stated that they would not be asking or inquiring about immigration status. But there was an important exception there, and it stated that it was unless there was an individual who was related to criminal violations or threats of violent behavior. And I think that's something that we should pay attention to, because that's a fairly weak statement in terms of the extent to which the university will function as an agent of the federal government regarding enforcement of federal immigration laws. That's a broad policy. Anyone could get caught up in something related to criminal behavior. And once that Pandora's box is open and people are put at risk, that's not something that we can close again.
Are there other things that Cornell could be doing? I mean, in preparing for this interview, I looked online at a lot of other universities. For example, at George Mason University in Virginia, DACA students are paying in-state tuition. And George Mason is a public university, just like parts of Cornell is. Mm-hmm. Yet I don't think that's happening at Cornell.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's a number of things that we could discuss here that the university can do and I hope will do. For sure, the group of my colleagues and I who are part of the Cornell Coalition for Inclusive Democracy have asked the administration to give us concrete policies regarding a number of things. But sure, if we look at a number of different principles that have been issued at places like George Mason, but also University of California, there are questions around funding. So for example, in the contract colleges, there's questions of whether or not we abide by SUNY policies for in-state tuition. And I think that there are some internal institutional hurdles that the leadership has decided not to take on. I think there's also questions about what will happen and what are the commitments being made to those students who will fall out of DACA status. I think the current presidential administration has made clear that they are going to do all they can to remove DACA. They've backed off a bit on that, but I don't think we can continue to assume that DACA will be in place once those individuals kind of age out of it after 2 years. And so what's going to happen to that new population of students? They've made commitments to students who have come in with DACA, but what's going to happen going forward? Are we going to revert back to our old policy, which treated undocumented students as international students? And that is that would be very worrisome.
You mentioned SUNY policy. I think it's important for people to know that what SUNY policy says is that non-resident students, including undocumented students who attend for at least 2 years and graduate from a New York high school, may be eligible for resident tuition, whereas as international students are not eligible for resident tuition.
Correct. So those are individuals who meet those criteria. If you go to a SUNY or a CUNY, you are eligible for in-state tuition. And that's been incredibly beneficial. It doesn't go far enough, unlike California, which also provides in-state financial aid. There's a legislative hurdle there. But I do think that the university has made a step towards providing financial aid for those with DACA. But the question is, what happens when DACA is not there? And what happens for those individuals who don't have DACA? DACA is an arbitrary policy that has nothing to do with educational excellence. And so my question is, what commitments are we making to those individuals who we've admitted to our university, and how are we complying with state policy, particularly in the contract colleges?
Shannon, not everyone comes into contact every day with undocumented students or students that are part of the DACA program. Can you give us just an example of what life is like for an undocumented student? What are some of their concerns? What are their worries?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to first start by saying I don't mean to speak for my undocumented students or those with DACA. I think it's important for faculty to act as allies, but not to take voice from them. And so I encourage you to take a look at the publications that the undocumented student movement has put out as well. I think some of these issues are everyday things that we take for granted, including, for example, having access to identification and being able to move through life without the threat of small infractions being turned into a ticket to deportation. So I was in a car the other day that got stopped for a headlight that was out. It's very possible that in the current context, especially moving forward, if requested, if you were unable to produce the documentation that satisfied that state or state trooper, for example, who falls outside the current city policy, you could have Border Patrol interactions with Border Patrol very soon thereafter. Small things like that. Of course, also things like being able to travel, the current policy around advanced parole for those individuals who have DACA is effectively not in place anymore.
Wait, what does that mean,
advanced parole? So advanced parole is a policy that gave emergency permission for someone to travel either for medical purposes, if to visit a family member, or for educational purposes. Effectively speaking, that policy is not in place anymore. So an individual who has DACA would be counseled at this point, I believe, not to study abroad, not to travel to see a sick family member. Obviously, being able to graduate from an Ivy League university like Cornell is an amazing feat. But what do you do with that degree afterwards? And if DACA were to be removed, the question is, what would the work authorization landscape look like for those individuals? And of course, the risk of deportation. I think individuals who are out of status or have DACA experience the same trials and tribulations that any of us do, but it's accentuated by their lack of access to security and wondering what their next steps will be in this country, in which many of them have lived almost their entire lives.
It's interesting to look at what some of the other universities around the country are doing. Tufts is meeting 100% of the demonstrated need for all admitted students. Franklin and Marshall considers undocumented students eligible for the same aid as any U.S. citizen. I'm just curious, what about, as far as financial assistance is concerned, should an undocumented student or a student with DACA status have either an admissions or financial aid advantage over a U.S. citizen? Why or why not?
I think that's a great point. I think the way to reframe that is to ask, what are the commitments that the university is making to the students of academic excellence that we've admitted, regardless of immigration status? Those students are being admitted on the basis of their academic merit because they belong in this university, not because they're taking another person's place. So I think the better way to look at it is, what are the commitments that we're making to those individuals? I do know that international students more generally do not qualify for financial aid. But I want to caution us to not necessarily look at the population of individuals who have been here, gone to high school here, and lived their lives here in that same pool. Obviously, the challenges that those students have overlap, and they should be working, and I think many of do work in solidarity. So I don't think, rather than pitting them against each other, we should be thinking about the resources that a university has and how do they honor the commitments to those students who they've admitted.
I mean, some universities they realize that they cannot give, under federal law, I guess, they cannot give federal financial assistance to an undocumented student. So what they're doing is looking for private assistance. They're increasing their development efforts and trying to find funders that want to support undocumented students.
Absolutely. I think the question of whether or not Cornell has the resources to do this as it is another conversation. But I think that we raise money for all sorts of things on campus. We raise money for sports. We raise money for specific programs. We may raise money for specific categories of students. And there are private donors who have approached many faculty and who have worked with the university and are willing to support these students. I think we should think of this as a multi-pronged effort where we are supporting legislative change at the state level and looking for funds. And I think we should be pushing back against the threats to remove federal funding and be very concerned about the incoming leadership at the U.S. Department of Education. But we should also be looking at, in the short term, how can we leverage our internal development efforts. And there's many of us faculty who are very excited about helping in that regard.
To your knowledge, is the university coming up with any ways to accept Syrian refugees as students or faculty members?
I think that's a good question and one that I can only speak broadly to. I think one of the conversations we've been having with our leadership is how to provide resources to our colleagues who may be from Syria in a position where they're unable to return to their country. I think there's questions about housing, and I think there's questions about how we will invite visiting scholars who might find themselves in this position. So I think Syria is certainly one of the countries that is affected by this, but more broadly, I think there's a number of different countries that are. I think that we should be thinking about this, obviously, with the 7 countries that are affected, including Syria, but more broadly as well. So I think we've started that conversation, and I hope that the leadership continues in that direction.
I'm just curious, is there any personal experience that you've had or personal story that's partly responsible for you getting interested in immigration issues in general?
Sure. I think I like to remind my student that I'm a perfect example about the arbitrary nature of immigration policy. My mother immigrated to this country in the 70s, and my great-grandfather on my father's side immigrated to this country in the early part of the 20th century. They came under very different policies and were granted very different benefits. And so I'm very much the child of immigrants, and I'm interested in making sure that we as a country don't repeat the inequities of the past.
Well, Shannon Gleason, thank you so much for coming in tonight.